This is Rocky Mountain Voices, powered by PodTech.
For 10 years now, we've had the same architecture, and everything has gotten better because the clock speeds have gone up and up and up. And that stopped about a year ago. And so computers stopped getting faster, and that has a profound effect. And we are on the cusp of trying to figure out how to deal with that.
Welcome to Rocky Mountain Voices. This is Kip Meekum, and it's just a couple of hours before the start of this evening's Utah Technology Council 2006 Hall of Fame celebration, and we're speaking with Dr. Jim Kajiya, distinguished engineer and general manager of Microsoft Research, and one of two of this year's inductees into the Utah Technology Council's Hall of Fame. Dr. Kajiya, congratulations to you, and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Kip. It's really nice to be on this.
Dr. Kajiya has received his doctorate in computer science from the University of Utah back in 1979. Tell our listeners, if you could, about your Utah connections, including the doctorate and perhaps beyond that if there are others, that have really led to this induction into the Utah Technology Council's Hall of Fame.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Actually, I was brought to Utah. I was brought to Utah by David Evans, who's another one of the Hall of Fame inductees. David and Ivan Sutherland had founded this company called Evans & Sutherland, which in the 70s, 80s, and 90s were a major vendor of computer graphics hardware, which at the time was a very high-end stuff that, you know, was used in flight simulators and things like that. And I was just hired on as an engineer in the pretty much the first third of the 70s. And so the Utah connection started there, and, you know, my wife and I lived in Salt Lake all through graduate school and through some of my engineering time engineering at Evans & Sutherland, and it's it really was a wonderful opportunity for, you know, meeting a stellar group of people that David and Ivan had brought together to University of Utah. At the time, it was really quite a phenomenon.
Clearly, a lot of history in technology harkens back to those pioneering and innovative steps that came out of Evans & Sutherland. They left a really big footprint on the industry.
Yes, and I think David Evans did that not only through his company, but also through the, you know, founding of the computer science department at the U, and the people that he had brought, people like Thomas Stockham, and who was my thesis advisor at Utah, was, you know, they were just phenomenal coups that he'd managed to attract people out to almost an ab initio department that didn't exist before he'd founded it.
You know, your biography says that your doctorate is in computer science. Can you elaborate on a little bit about what your dissertation was about, or what did you add to the body of knowledge, if I may?
Sure. Well, my dissertation, which is a long time ago, was about computer vision. And specifically, it was about image processing and the modeling of human vision so that computers could process images more effectively. Because obviously, if you can understand a little bit about how people see images, then you can make computer image processing algorithms, things that, for example, take a blurry picture and de-blur it, or take a noisy picture and figure out where the edges are and, you know, sort of clean it up and things like that. If you know how the vision system works, then you know what the eye pays attention to and what the eye doesn't pay attention to. And so you can do lots of algorithms that get what the eye cares about right and takes what the eye doesn't care about and, you know, could even throw it away. Certainly, and that kind of thing has evolved over the years and is used, for example, in MPEG for audio and for video. There are very simplistic but nonetheless important computer models of how the eye or the ear works, and it throws away bits so that the stuff that you don't hear isn't coded very accurately, but the stuff that you do hear is coded very accurately. And so, you know, perceptual models for human vision were, turned out to be a very important field for technology, and my dissertation was about new approaches to making models for human perception.
It reminds me of the book I read last year by George Gilder called The Silicon Eye, where he talks about exploits of the folks at Foveon creating a...
Right, Carver's company, yes.
Exactly. Well, share with us for a few minutes, Jim, your thoughts on what this award means to you personally, as well as its meaning to the technology community in Utah at large.
Well, you know, I think the technology community in Utah has always been underappreciated. You know, all the news is, you know, coming out of sort of MIT, and all the news comes out of Silicon Valley, and everybody thinks of those as tech centers. And if you were to ask, you know, anyone on the street where the country's technological centers are, Salt Lake and you know, the Utah area would not come to people's minds immediately. And that is actually a very undeserved reputation. And I think, you know, one of these, the UTC Hall of Fame serves to show that, in fact, there are a lot of, you know, very well-known and interesting people who have, you know, who owe a large part of their career to the community here in Utah. And some of the previous award winners are very famous, and I'm a little puzzled why I'm on this list, because I certainly didn't found companies or do, you know, major commercial things. I'm much more of, you know, just a scientist than a real mover and shaker in industry.
Well, I think the fact that you are a scientist is perhaps an increasingly rare commodity in the United States, and I think that to me is very significant about this recognition. I'm hoping that, you know, this creates some visibility for the sciences in the state, in the region, because as you pointed out, I think Utah is seldom out engineered but often out marketed.
Indeed, that's really the case. I think, you know, the coasts have a lot better PR machine.
sadly for us, that's true. If one stops and thinks about it, it's clear that Microsoft makes significant investments in research and development. But just as most people don't associate Utah as a technology center, I don't think people think of Microsoft primarily as a center for research and technology advancement. Can you give us a little bit of background about Microsoft Research?
Well, you know, Microsoft Research just celebrated its 15th anniversary. It's been going on since about 1991, and I joined in 1994, when it was still quite small. And, you know, the perception of any organization tends to lag the reality of the organization by a number of years, depending on how well they do their marketing and tell their story and all of that. But, you know, Microsoft, I think very early on, and this was really Bill Gates' vision and Nathan Myhrvold's vision, when Microsoft was still a very much smaller company than it is today, you know, when it was just barely over $1 billion, they decided that they really needed to do research in computer science, and not just to do applied research, but to do fundamental research to push back the boundaries of what we know in computer science. And they established a research lab and, you know, hired Rick Rashid, who, you know, was one of the leading computer scientists at the time, to do a very serious research effort that was not purely directed toward extensions of products. Now, it turns out that by hiring very, very good people and by investing heavily in a wide range of things in computer science, Microsoft has been able to reap the products of that research division in many different ways. It turned out that it was an incredibly prescient thing to do, and it, you know, almost every Microsoft product that is available today has taken advantage of research in some way, and we wouldn't have been able to ship the product in the present form without the research in fundamental computer science that has been done at Microsoft Research. So part of the, you know, you're exactly right in talking about that analogy there. Microsoft Research is actually quite well known in the various research communities. You know, if you look in computer graphics or you know, software engineering research or, you know, computer vision or, you know, you name any field of research in computer science, and you'll find that Microsoft Research has a pretty significant presence in there in terms of, you know, the number of papers, which is the measure of new ideas that come out in any particular field. That Microsoft Research has a pretty good presence in that area, and I think if you talk with the leading researchers in almost any field of computer science, they would not disagree with the observation that Microsoft is doing some very important and cutting-edge research. But that story hasn't gotten out to the general public, and it's, you you know, been much like the situation with Utah, I think.
Tell us, if you would, what you're tell us what you're currently working on that you can kind of talk about without having to kill us.
Well, you know, just to address your previous question, you know, it just occurred to me that, you know, in Microsoft Research, we did the first hotspot, the first Wi-Fi hotspot. And yeah, we did it years and years and years ago, and then it became very popular and all of that. But there was a small little food court at a mall down just south of Microsoft that a lot of Microsoft people went to, and a bunch of the researchers, and led by Victor Ball, said, hey, you know, we could just wire this up and make Wi-Fi access available to anybody there. And so he did it. He you know, talked to the shopping center owner and said, oh, well, that sounds like a cool thing. And, you know, we put it together and, you know, we got the equipment in there and made the first hotspot.
Tell us about some of the things that you're currently working on that you can tell us about, and, you know, what some major problems are that you're trying to solve, and perhaps the fruits that we can expect to see in the future from Microsoft Research.
Well, you know, one of the really important things that's going on right now is that computer architecture is changing quite radically.
Are we talking CPU? Are we talking memory? We're talking
CPU.
All of the above.
Well, we're talking about CPU and its relationship to memory, and, you know, having computers get faster and the whole thing. You know, for 10 years now, we've had pretty much the same architecture with minor variations. And everything has gotten better because the clock speeds have gone up and up and up. And that stopped about a year ago. And it stopped about a year ago because of heat, which is something that people who looked at the foundations of computer logic had predicted, 25 years ago, 30 years ago now. Carver Mead actually wrote one of the earliest fundamental papers on the limits of semiconductor scaling and pointed out that heat was going to be the problem that everyone would run into. And that happened about a year ago. And so computers stopped getting faster. The clock rate stopped going up, but we could still use more transistors. Moore's law didn't stop. We could still use more transistors, but those transistors couldn't be pushed faster. And that has a profound effect on applications, on how we build those applications, and all manner of software, down to the basic algorithm level, and also how we organize computation and how we organize processors. And right now, we are on the cusp of trying to figure out how to deal with that. The thing that the industry is doing right now is to put multiple computers on a single chip, the so-called multi-core architecture.
Exactly.
But that's a stopgap. That is a stopgap. We're doing that because we don't know what else to do. But it's clear that that approach is going to run into severe problems, mainly because it isn't solving the processor memory bandwidth problem. In fact, it doesn't help it at all. And so there are some fundamental changes that are going to come in the computing world. And in fact, everyone is sort of scrambling to figure out how to deal with those things. And in fact, if we don't do that, then in, you know, this virtuous cycle that causes exciting new applications to happen because we have more computer power, which causes, you know, more investment, which causes people to research things to make more computing power happen, that virtuous cycle, which is really what Moore's law is about, it's really a social phenomenon, a socioeconomic phenomenon, that will come to a screeching halt if we can't deliver computing power in a way that will mean things to people.
Oh, the economic implications of that are staggering.
Indeed it is. So that problem, that is a looming problem, and it has many, many different aspects. From, you know, how should we do computer architecture? What kind of software do we need to, you know, how does software need to change? How do programming languages need to change? How do computer algorithms need to change? And how do applications need to change? All of that is up for grabs right now, and it's a major problem that everyone in the industry is worrying about right now. Certainly, Microsoft Research is definitely a player in that regard, but it's the entire industry. It's the entire industry, and it's all of academic computer science research. I mean, it's everybody on the planet that has to deal with this question. It's not just Microsoft Research.
So, but these will be transformative breakthroughs when they occur.
Yes, and if they don't occur, it's going to be equally transformative.
Apart from the work that you do in your day job at Microsoft Research, is there some problem, you know, be it large or small, that lurks out there in your mind that, you know, personally is a windmill that you might like to tilt at or have a hand in solving?
Oh, you bet. I mean, one of the most fascinating things that could come along is programmable matter.
You're talking about replicator technology from Star Trek,
yeah,
metaphor, right?
Yeah, stuff like replicator technology, nanotech. But Neil Gershenfeld at MIT has a very interesting academic program and he wrote a book about it called SAB, which is, you know, basically a personal device that could sit on your desktop and make things. And that kind of thing, I think, is going to be very interesting because we've seen incredible benefits from information technology in terms of communication, in terms of telecommunications, and now, you know, in terms of media, right? Because it's all, you know, it's all information. But it's had tremendous influence. It's made a lot of good things happen, and it's destroyed a lot of old business models. But, you know, by and large, it's a giant leap forward. If, in fact, we can do that same thing with matter, that, you know, you can download objects, it would be very interesting, because then what it says is that things aren't inherently valuable. It's really the design of the things that are inherently valuable. And because, you know, if you look at the cost of materials that goes into a Rolex watch versus, you know, a Timex watch, I mean, the cost of materials on either side is not terribly different. And it's all design. And in the end, if we can extend that paradigm, that digital paradigm, to be able to put objects through wires, I think it'll be very interesting.
So what are you doing to solve the problem?
Well, you know, we're a long, long way away from doing that. There are, you know, thousands of people working on this issue, you know, from biologists to material scientists to, you know, people who study CAD. And, you know, my expertise is in computer graphics, and the design of how you being able to specify how things should be built is really a very tough issue. And even if we could manipulate basic atoms, and, you know, in an efficient way, we can manipulate basic atoms now, but we can't do it very efficiently. But even if we could, we wouldn't know how to, you know, develop the structures and the design paradigm to actually make useful things out of those things. Right now, they're just these little tiny things that are, you know, almost just stunts because they're all done by hand. But to make a really useful technology, you have to get somebody something from, you know, a design from somebody's head, somebody's concept into the machine in a way that it can be manufactured. And you know, we've seen a revolution in computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing at a very large level, but it hasn't translated into, you know, this other world. And, you know, that's going to happen over the next few decades, and I hope to play a small part in that.
Well, it's interesting. It seems to me if it's almost like your work is the user interface to this programmable matter.
Yep. I think that's a good way of putting it, right? If you could make anything, right, just by describing it, what would you want to do to describe it? I mean, what would you have to do? And what kind of tools do we need to be able to have ordinary people describe objects and have them appear?
What a wonderful problem to work on.
Yeah, it's not one that's going to be solved tomorrow. But
So as you said, we're probably decades, not years, away from this.
Right.
Well, we'll hope to see life extension technology allow us all to hang on long enough to realize the fruits of research. Jim, where can our listeners go to learn a little bit more about Microsoft Research?
That's easy. It's research.microsoft.com.
Well, we've been speaking today with Dr. Jim Kajiya. Jim, thank you very much for a fascinating podcast, and congratulations on this prestigious award. And
well, thanks very much, Kip. Thanks for having me.
In Salt Lake City, for Rocky Mountain Voices, this is Kip Meekum.
This has been a Rocky Mountain Voices podcast. Visit us on the internet at www.rockymountainvoices.com.